Getting Fixed, a novel by Myrna Milani, read by Myrna Milani, all rights reserved. Chapter 13. While David and Marilyn grappled with their heady issues, much of Kelly's life revolved around Billy. Once they had a definitive diagnosis, she had sought out the latest scientific data on pancreatic cancer, only to discover that almost all of it dealt with complex curative strategies rather than patient comfort. At the same time, though, virtually all of the articles written from the patient's point of view talked about the debilitating pain associated with the disease, and many of these articles provided statistics supporting what she already knew. By the time the patient experienced sufficient discomfort to realize that something was wrong, it was too late. Kelly accepted all that and had no regrets whatsoever about Billy's desire to die at home. However, as the time went on, the fact that he did so well both delighted and troubled her. Could the diagnosis have been wrong? Should she have permitted the biopsy? Admittedly, over time, Billy's appetite did decrease, as did his ability to digest many foods without discomfort. But the staff at the clinic worked out a schedule of pain medication and a diet that wouldn't tax his limited digestive capacity more than necessary. Just like Bernice, Billy had signed with a grin when he saw Callie cooking his lunch, a comment that caused her to laugh at the bland but nutritious gruel she had prepared for him. "That bad?" she asked as she offered him the spoon to lick. He licked the spoon and stared at the ceiling, pretending to be engrossed in deep thought, then signed with an even wider grin, "Not too bad if I don't have to eat a lot of it at one time." That exchange made Callie realize what made Billy different from the others faced with the same condition and probably explained why he was doing so well. Unlike those with full mental capacity who often experience severe depression when hit with an imminent terminal diagnosis, Billy escaped many of their fears. He had no worries about wills or insurance. He lived in the moment. He had no regrets and no unfulfilled dreams, because his needs and dreams were so few, so simple, and so easily fulfilled. Would that she could be so lucky. Billy's gentle acceptance of his fate bought him more time, but eventually the day arrived when he couldn't come to the granary with Callie. She had stopped to pick him up as usual and to help him with whatever tasks were beyond his reach that day. Sometimes that meant fixing breakfast for him and Curly. Other times it meant doing nothing more than helping him get into the van. But on this particular morning, he couldn't even get out of bed. "Bad night?" she signed. He nodded and added, "Hurt much." Each night Joe would leave pain medication for Billy to take during the night if the prescribed dosage didn't suffice. At first Billy didn't need it, but during that week the pills had been gone every morning when she arrived. "Today you'll rest, and I'll call the clinic and get some better pills for you." She gave him her most reassuring smile as she conveyed the message to him. "Penn will need you at the store." A worried frown accompanied Billy's gestures. "No, the tourist season's over. Penn will be fine." In reality, Penn hadn't needed her for weeks. He'd only hired little Susie with a broken leg for the summer, and she had already gone back to school. "Penn, why are you keeping me on when you really don't need the help?" Callie had finally asked him. "There are a lot of things around here that need to be done that just don't get done when it's busy," he answered, but he avoided eye contact when he said it. "Maybe, but what's the real reason?" "I enjoy the company," he replied, then deliberately looked from her to Billy, who stacked boxes of dog biscuits while Curly lay quietly at his feet. "Life's too short to forget that, Callie." Callie first called Penn to report Billy's condition. Penn sighed the sigh of someone hearing sad but not unexpected news and told her to give Billy his best. She then called the clinic, where she was put on hold by Andy's nurse, who then went to confer with the physician, creating a void that was immediately filled by an arrangement of Pachelbel's Canon, so soporific that callers often had to struggle to stay awake. Callie was no exception. The nurse's sudden assurance that Andy would come to Billy's during his lunch hour pierced a music-induced fog surrounding her. "But that's not necessary," she protested, recalling the always crowded waiting room at the clinic. "Maybe after Billy eats and rests some more, he'll feel well enough to make the trip." "No," Andy insisted. The woman replied in a voice that clearly communicated that she shared his view. Go ahead and double the pain medication and do whatever you can to make Billy comfortable in the meantime. And we need to think about making any changes in the house that will make things easier for him, too. Callie hung up, feeling touched by the clinic staff's concern, both for Billy and for her. In her own gentle way, Andy's nurse had just told her that the time had come to convert Billy's cottage into a hospice. Andy will come to see you around lunchtime. If you feel like it, we can play until then, she relayed the message to Billy. What will we play? First we'll play, Let's All Eat Callie's Paste for Breakfast. Will Curly eat it too? Billy signed with a tired grin. Getting Billy to eat had become more and more of a challenge, but Curly was a canine garbage can. Putting these two facts together, Callie commandeered the dog for medical duty. If Curly eats it, you have to eat it too. Okay? Billy agreed, and she offered some of the mixture to the dog. Fortunately, Curly didn't let her down. He gobbled up his bland treat with such gusto that Billy felt obligated to eat his own. Then she told Billy about the forthcoming changes in his home. We need to change things around so you'll be more comfortable. Get you a new bed that goes up and down so you can watch television. The television is in the living room, he reminded her. We'll put the new bed in the living room, too. It's bigger, and it will be easier for your friends to visit you there. Billy liked that idea a lot, then came up with one of his own. Would Joe let me decorate a wall in the living room, too? He signed, pointing to where photos of himself with Nana and Curly arced over his bed. I'm sure he will. We can cover all of the walls, she added with a big grin, thinking of all the pictures Billy must have accumulated over the years. That answer brought a smile to Billy's face, too, and earned her a hug. Put Billy's whole life on the walls. Very good. I would like that. Once Billy became bedridden, yet another pattern evolved. Callie would get up early each morning and feed the cats, a practice that caused all of them to streak out of the bedroom and fly into the cat room as if they'd never seen canned cat food before. In reality, they'd never seen so much canned cat food before. The more time she spent away from home, the guiltier she felt, and the more canned food than dry she fed them. While they ate, she cleaned litter boxes and did other cat-related chores. When they finished, she washed their little bowls, told them all she loved them, and fed and cleaned up herself. No later than 7:30, she arrived at Billy's and relieved whoever had spent the night with him. During the day, she attended to Billy's needs, arranged and rearranged the house to accommodate his increasing medical paraphernalia, cooked and cleaned. After she fed him his dinner, or later set up any necessary IVs and put out any medications he might need during the night, she would leave him with one of the other volunteers and go home, sometimes stopping at the grocery store on her way. At home, she'd feed the cats, microwave something for dinner, and fall into bed with the cat's pout all over her. 7 days a week. Even though others might consider this the schedule from hell, Callie didn't see it that way for two very special reasons, Billy and his photographs. Callie had had no idea how many pictures he had accumulated until he had directed her to a hall closet that contained boxes of all sizes and shapes, every one of them filled with pictures to the point of bursting, crammed into every available inch of space from the closet floor to its ceiling. Oldest ones on the bottom, open them first, Billy had signed from his bed. She looked at the uneven piles that threatened to tumble down on her at any minute and grinned at him. I'll do my best. It took Callie the whole day to remove all the boxes and put them in some kind of order, but by the time she got ready to go home, Billy sat up in bed, sorting through his baby pictures and enjoying every minute of it. From an early age, he'd taken about 2/3 of the pictures himself, and the remainder others had taken of him. The net result was a pictorial chronicle of his life from his own and his loved ones' points of view. Look! He waved a picture excitedly just as Callie picked up her purse and car keys. There they were, two little dirt balls in sunsuits, lying face down on the ground watching Ann swarm over Billy's peanut butter sandwich. She laughed and squeezed his hand. So long ago. Before I had a camera, Billy replied. Then he rummaged through the box and held up a picture of two individuals blurred beyond recognition. Billy's first picture, my parents, he signed proudly. Kelly looked at the date on the back of the picture. Bernice and Howard had an old camera they never let her, a straight-A student and Ms. Responsibility, touch until she entered high school. Billy's folks gave him their camera to use when he was 3. In the days that followed, Billy and Kelly spent many happy hours deciding how to arrange his pictures. They both agreed that she should put his favorites where he could see them most easily. That meant moving the Nana and Curly arc from his bedroom to above his hospital bed in the living room, and then adding a 2-foot-wide band of photos to the right and left of the bed. However, Billy had so many favorites that the band of pictures soon encircled the entire room. Many of the pictures closest to Billy were of himself and the different Nanas over the years. Until she actually pinned them all to the wall, Callie had never realized how physically distinctive the 4 dogs were. True, they were all black, but there any resemblance ended. The first Nana was a smooth-coated black lab mix with floppy ears. Nanas 2 and 4 had medium-length hair and erect ears that both probably owed to some German Shepherd dog ancestors. Nana 3's size, elongated muzzle, and close-set eyes definitely bespoke of some collie in her mix. Nana 2 was also a male. In fact, Callie didn't remember at all. In spite of all those differences, though, each one of the 4 dogs radiated Nana in the pictures, especially when they looked at Billy. Curly did, too. We should have called Curly Nana, she signed. Billy shook his head. He is Nana, but he's different, too. He'll stay after I'm gone. He needed a different name. Callie nodded and quickly turned away so he wouldn't see her tears. When Callie and Billy began filling in the remainder of the wall space with pictures, they always agreed where she should put up a certain picture and the color of the thumbtack she should use to put it there. But while they never differed about the location or color of the thumbtacks, they sometimes did disagree about whether she should hang certain pictures at all. Why not? Good picture of Chucky Getz with pretty lady at party, Billy signed the first time it happened. Chucky did look good for Chucky, but Callie suspected that few who saw the picture would miss the meaning of the expression on his face. It seemed pretty obvious that the pretty lady with her breast practically falling out of her blouse understood it too. Good picture, but pretty lady, not Chucky's wife, she told him. I know. Chucky's wife looks like fat fish. Yes, but it might hurt her feelings if she saw the pretty lady with Chucky. Kelly knew this argument would work because, regardless how others might treat him, Billy always tried very hard not to hurt anyone's feelings. As they went through the pictures and added to Billy's collage, Kelly had to prevail upon his basic goodness a surprising number of times. It soon became apparent that Billy and his camera had become so much a part of everyone's lives that, at least sometimes, he became invisible to them, even as he maintained an uncanny awareness of the idiosyncrasies in their lives. Day by day, the large box Callie had set aside for centered pictures grew fuller and fuller, until it contained snapshots of practically everyone, even the town's most virtuous citizens, including her. Pretty, Billy signed as he handed the photo to her. Callie looked at the picture and felt like she had just stepped out of a time machine. Zed had just run off with a topless dancer, and she had come home to try to put some order into her life, a recurring theme of hers. Bernice suggested she get a job with a company that specialized in taking high school yearbook pictures. As long as there are schools and children, there will be school pictures, she declared sagely, as she picked at the lint balls that tenaciously clung to her polyester slacks like legions of fuzzy limpets. As you get older, you need to think more about security. Venus thought Callie should join a circus. You'd be perfect, Callie, she insisted, as she twirled on the dining room table in her gauzy dress. You love animals so much. Get some little dogs and train them to do tricks. Or maybe you could ride an elephant. Wouldn't it be fun to ride an elephant? Howard didn't offer any suggestions, probably because painting the car at Bernice's request took up most of his time then. "Why does Mom want the car painted?" Kelly asked during one of her post-dinner 15 seconds of talk with Father opportunities. He shrugged. "When I got back from my last fishing trip, she said blue cars depressed her." Then he confided in Kelly for the only time in her life. "I think she's having female problems." "Aren't you supposed to use some special kind of paint?" Kelly next asked, gesturing toward the gallon cans of pea-green high-gloss house paint lined up by the kitchen door. "There's only so much a man can do, Kelly," he announced as he looked at his watch. "And I've done it." Then he got up from the table and went into the living room to watch television. After a few days like that, Kelly felt an overwhelming urge to retreat to Billy and her secret cove and lie naked on the beach. She needed to do something scandalously normal to remind herself that she wasn't like her parents and never would be. Naturally, as soon as Nana appeared, she immediately yanked on her shorts and shirt. And true, she did feel somewhat surprised when Billy appeared from the opposite direction, but like everyone else in town, she didn't give it a second thought. "Put picture here." Billy pointed to a space directly beside his bed, just above one of Joe and Curly. "No, I don't think so," Kelly replied, feeling, of all things, a blush creeping up her neck to her face. "Why not? Joe would like," Billy's hands insisted. Kelly had no doubt Joe would like. In fact, she easily imagined photos of naked women tacked all over his bedroom walls and probably on the ceiling as well. However, if ever a picture existed that would never see the light of day on Billy's walls, that of her naked body was the one. "Nice people don't appear naked in public," she ended the discussion as she tossed a picture into the censored box with the others. Word soon got out about Billy's picture walls, and an almost constant stream of visitors came to see them and him. When Chucky Getz showed up, Kelly realized that self-preservation rather than a desire to visit the sick might be motivating some of them. "That must have been quite a party," she innocently remarked when she noticed him examining a picture of himself with his fish-faced wife. "Did Billy take any other pictures there?" Chucky gulped nervously and played with his skinny black tie. "Oh, tons," she reported nonchalantly. "We all got so used to his camera, sometimes some of us forgot he was even there." Kelly knew that remark would strike a responsive chord with Chucky because, of all those who had grown up with Billy, he treated Billy with the least respect. "Say, Kelly," Chucky leaned against her and began to rub her back much, much too familiarly with his clammy hand, "I don't suppose you'd let me see those other pictures, would you?" "Not in a million years," she snapped, peeling off his hand. Chucky, being the little creep he'd been from day one, turned to leave without saying a word to Billy. "I strongly suggest you spend a little time cheering Billy up before you go," Kelly strongly suggested to him, then added, "if you know what's good for you." She opened the top two buttons of her blouse, held her breasts up to give her more cleavage, and made slurpy kissing noises in case he missed the point. He didn't, but she wasn't sure that the person who entered the doorway behind him at that moment got it. "That looked pretty interesting," Joe remarked, while Chucky fawned over Billy so flagrantly, Kelly wished she had just kicked him out instead. "Just a little slime bucket blackmail," she replied, buttoning her blouse. "Why aren't you off hacking trees?" "I need to talk to you," he replied, then gestured toward the kitchen when three more visitors arrived to see Billy and admire his walls, as well as possibly check for incriminating evidence. "What's the problem?" She automatically poured a cup of coffee for Joe and picked up her own cup of now cold tea. "I think there's something seriously wrong with Curly," he announced gravely. "No!" Kelly couldn't believe it. The dog looked perfectly fine to her, and she spent hours with him every day. "Why do you think that?" "His shit's blue." She looked at Joe's very worried expression and burst out laughing, and kept laughing till tears ran down her face. "I'm glad you think it's so damn funny," he snapped. "I'm sorry, I forgot all about it," she apologized between spasms of laughter. "Forgot all about what?" "The food coloring." "What food coloring?" "The food coloring I put in Curly's food to get Billy to eat. If Curly eats, Billy eats too," she explained. "Didn't you notice the yellow and green?" "Well, yeah, but I thought you'd fed him a lot of eggs and lettuce those days." That made her start laughing all over again and only exasperated him more. Why didn't you put the damn coloring in Billy's food instead of the dog's? He growled. Kelly sobered up immediately. I didn't want to risk it. He eats so little as it is. She let the words trail off, the release of all that emotion suddenly making her realize how very tired she was, so tired she could easily cry, and that would never do. I should have told you, and I'm sorry you worried, she apologized again in an effort to maintain her composure. There's so much to do, sometimes I just can't keep track of it all. Maybe if you'd fucked me. Joe reverted to type as the reality of her life hit him. Kelly fled back to Billy and his guests because she knew if she stayed any longer, she'd cry rather than laugh, as Joe expected. That night, Kelly read the first paragraph of yet another lengthy email from David about the plans for his impending wedding. She fell asleep with the words, "I must tell him the truth," ringing in her ears. However, any thoughts about David's wedding completely vanished from her mind the next morning when she arrived at Billy's and Penn greeted her, looking tired and concerned. "Bad night?" she asked. He nodded. "Very. The pain medication just doesn't seem to be working anymore." "I'll take care of it," she assured him. They all knew this would happen eventually, but some disagreement had arisen about how to handle it. Billy's deteriorating digestive capacity made giving him oral medications increasingly problematic. Andy favored switching to injectables, but Billy hated needles, and Kelly didn't like the idea of him spending his last days like that. "What about a morphine pump?" she had proposed at the last meeting of his caregivers. "I'm not sure about the ethics of giving someone like Billy the ability to medicate himself," countered Andy. "We can limit how much we want him to have," one of the visiting nurses reminded him. "Plus, Billy knows a lot more than people give him credit for," added one of the volunteers, a sentiment that caused many of the others to nod their heads in agreement. "Even so," someone else chimed up, "what about addiction?" "I don't think addiction's a valid issue," Kelly commented. "Billy's not going to live long enough to become addicted. Even if he did, I think that's a price worth paying to control his pain." After the meeting, Andy caught up with her in the clinic parking lot. "I don't want you to think I want Billy to experience any unnecessary pain." He verbalized a thought that had never crossed her mind. She had worked closely with him during those months, and, although their views didn't coincide on this particular issue, she never questioned his genuine concern for Billy, a belief she readily shared with him. He appeared relieved to know that, then added, "I hope you're with him when he dies. Your training, your work..." He faltered and then continued, "You're so much better prepared for this than I am." Then Kelly pledged something she had known from the beginning. "No matter when he dies, I'll be with him." Within minutes of Kelly's call to the clinic after Penn left that morning, Andy arrived and installed the pump. Although she had already prepared herself for the worst, once the medication took effect and the pain subsided, Billy's condition slowly improved. "I thought you weren't coming," he signed. "That scared me and made me hurt more." She hugged him gently and brushed soft downy hair out of his eyes. "I had to go home and feed the cats." "How are they?" Answering Billy's question enabled her to keep him occupied long enough for the medication to take full effect and for him to fall asleep with his fingers wrapped around the curls on Curly's head. As Billy had continued to lose weight, the dog had gained it. Curly now weighed about 65 pounds, but he had grown taller rather than filled out until he looked like a giant, randomly curled black Tootsie Roll with a head on stilts. But in spite of the fact that Curly almost matched Billy's more than 6-foot stature when he stretched out fully beside him, he could cram himself into remarkably small space if necessary to sleep with Billy. While Billy slept, Kelly set about her daily chores, which now included pinning up his many cards as well as the pictures he took of his visitors and they of him with one of the disposable cameras always on his bedside table. "He has a more exciting social life than I do." Curly's thumping tail and Joe's comment caused her to turn away from the wall that chronicled Billy's rapid decline as well as his many friends. The teasing smile on Joe's face reminded her how much alike he and Billy looked. "Me too." Then, realizing where such a comment might lead, Kelly addressed a more neutral and important concern. I periodically think about limiting the number of people and animals who visit him. It must tire him out. And yet not seeing his friends would be 10 times harder on him. I know. I've thought the same thing. It's the old quantity versus quality of life dilemma. Once again, she thought of her parents and their deaths, an unwelcome intrusion that occurred more frequently since she began taking care of Billy. She changed the subject to dispel it. What are you doing here? Aside from the pitiful state of my conjugal life, which you so heartlessly ignore, Penn told me Billy had a rough night, and I wanted to see if there was anything I could do. Nope. Everything's under control. Go off to the woods and hack down some more defenseless trees. You don't seem to mind burning them in your wood stove, he pointed out as he went to the kitchen to get himself a cup of coffee. You're right, she followed him and put on some water for tea. But the wood stove heats the house so much better than the furnace, and it feels so much nicer. It's my one vice. I think you should use the furnace anyway, and find another vice. Even if she had missed the meaning behind his words, only an idiot could miss the expression in his blue eyes. I think I'll stick with the wood stove, she told him, filling a bag with cookies from the dozens well-meaning visitors had brought to Billy. Here, she said, handing it to him. Go spread these around the woods for our animal friends. Joe tossed the bag of cookies onto the passenger seat of the truck and told himself he didn't care. He didn't care that Billy was dying. He didn't care that Callie looked like a piece of shit. All he cared about was that the events in Billy's life were complicating his, keeping him from earning as much as he wanted so he could earn enough to get the hell out of the Northeast for a while. Eat your fucking cookies, he muttered angrily to no one as he flung the homemade treats far and wide into the woodlot. Then he picked up his chainsaw and tried to drown his thoughts with sound. After Joe left, Callie continued sorting through Billy's photographs. As his condition worsened, they had made up a game in which she would add more pictures to the wall while he slept, and he'd try to find them when he woke up. To make this more exciting, she brought her binoculars for him to use, a gift that entertained him far more than she had expected. "Makes things bigger," he signed excitedly once he got the hang of focusing. She nodded, surprised that such a camera fan had never looked through binoculars before. "What do you use them for?" he asked. "Watching birds." That statement caused him to shift the binoculars from his wall to the bird feeder in the yard outside his window. The utter joy on his face that day caused her to grab his camera and take a few pictures herself. Kelly had added one of those pictures to the collection of animal photos she had put up for him to find. Now she searched for pictures of his and other parents to group together for his discovery. She found lots of pictures of Billy's folks, a wonderful couple who had had their only child late in life and always considered him their special gift. Rather than try to shelter him, they took him everywhere and did everything they could think of to make him self-sufficient. By the time they died, Billy belonged to the whole town. If Callie hadn't believed this, all the images she discovered of him standing between various couples like a proud son easily would have convinced her. While many of the pictures touched her deeply, none hit so hard as one of Billy standing between Bernice and Howard. The three of them stood in front of Penn's, and she guessed it had been taken sometime after she moved to California. Like practically all of the pictures taken after Billy's mother died, there was nothing written on the back to tell her the circumstances behind it. The tears streaming down her face accented the irony that her parents had destroyed their few family pictures because Bernice didn't want to make her sad. A flutter of motion from Billy's bed caught her attention. "Are you all right?" he signed sleepily. "What are you looking at?" She handed him the picture. "I found it, and it made me sad." "Don't be sad. They were good people." She wanted to scream at Billy that they were not good people. Good people didn't dress up like idiots and set up retarded deaf-mutes to find their bodies. Good people didn't die without saying goodbye. "You can have the picture if you want it." Billy's flying fingers broke into her internal rampage. "No, it belongs to you. Then put it with the pictures of the other parents." That didn't seem like the right thing to do because Bernice and Howard weren't like the other parents and never had been. But she agreed for Billy's sake. You've been listening to an excerpt from Getting Fixed, a novel by Myrna Milani, read by Myrna Milani. For more information about this and other books by the author, please visit mmilani.com. The song Irritations into Pearls was composed and performed by Jeff Firestone. For more information about Jeff and his music, please contact him at retromusic@verizon.net. Thanks for listening.